Well, I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. I hope you've recovered. Maybe your refrigerator is more filled than it was. Maybe with some leftovers. We have this nice menagerie of Tupperware. Whenever I open the fridge, you can kind of pick out what you want from the thing. So it's definitely my favorite holiday. I know I've talked about this before, but it is. It's always Christmas is the go-to favorite American holiday, I think, for any child like myself. But I think, you know, as I get older and as I appreciate food more, Thanksgiving has its almost rival with Christmas. It's pretty close. Some people call it Food Christmas. I see why. It's just a good holiday. But I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you had time maybe with family. Maybe you saw some people you don't normally see and you just had a good, you know, you're able to enjoy it. But, so you're still living on leftovers. And I'm just thinking about, because it's that time and I'm approaching the afternoon where I just start thinking about what's in my fridge. And, boy, I think, man, there's just food at Thanksgiving that you don't get any other time of the year, maybe Christmas or maybe like a big, you know, get together kind of thing. But man, like, I mean, turkey, like, who cooks a turkey any other time of the year than Thanksgiving? Again, you know, maybe Christmas, but really, it is an amazing, just that ritual of, is it gonna get done? That suspense that builds up, you know, is it over? Is it overdone? Is it underdone? Is it done yet? How about now? Can we eat now? No, it has to be a little more till the thing pops up, you know, whatever thing. You know, a green bean casserole. How come we don't eat that more often? How come that just isn't like every, you know, week we eat a green bean casserole? Some other like favorite foods. Some people like the congealed salad that you have. You know, yeah, at these Jell-O salad you pass around at the things like that. You never get that any other time of the year. My favorite. I'm gonna share this with you this morning. This is my don't say nothing, you know, useful was said this morning. But my favorite, this is, and Christmas is coming, so you can try this, is my culinary hero, Alton Brown. As many of you know, he has this macaroni and cheese, this baked macaroni and cheese casserole that he makes that is absolutely, absolutely amazing. And, well, the deal is you make it, and you serve it Thanksgiving or Christmas or whenever. And when you're done with it, you refrigerate it, you put it in the refrigerator, and then the next day, you get the thing out, and hopefully you didn't eat too many. In my house, I tell people, don't eat this. I know it looks nice, and I know it's on the table, but do not eat the macaroni and cheese, because you get it out the next day after it's set for a little bit. And you cut it into small kind of pieces. You batter it and deep fry it, and it is absolutely amazing. It is a little bit of hot sauce, and it is like it's a heart attack on a plate. It's absolutely amazing. But you know, Thanksgiving, and I hope you know you're on the mend from Thanksgiving. And it's ultimately more about food. It's more than just, you know, eating a lot. I think that's what our culture kind of makes it. And that's kind of what we celebrate, what we like to kind of talk about. But ultimately, the thing I love about Thanksgiving and the thing I love about Christmas, particularly Thanksgiving, and I think I'm still thinking about this, is it's not just about food. It's about, ultimately, it's about kind of like this original idea, this American idea of, you know, you have your pilgrims and your, whatever, your Indians, and they're coming together over a meal. And it's about people coming together to share something. Maybe people who normally wouldn't ever be together. It's that celebration of that togetherness that we have. And maybe you feel like at your Thanksgiving, maybe you felt like it was a little bit like pilgrims and Indians coming together. Maybe you felt like it was a little bit awkward. Maybe you felt like it was two sides here. And other than just to eat this turkey thing, we would never just normally hang out. And you kind of look at like around your Thanksgiving table and kind of look at, you know, as you remember, think about who was there. And, you know, you have like your weird family members kind of thing, and you think, boy, who are these people? Who are these pilgrims, you know, in my strange land kind of thing? You know, you think about, you know, our teenagers are actually great, but you think about maybe family has teenagers, and they're just on their phone, right, the whole time. And you're just like, who are you people? What is this? What is the thing? And you think about, like the crazy weird uncle who's always making inappropriate comments, you know, the whole time. And you're like, what are you doing in my house? You know, what are you, what is this? And I just feel like there's some strangers sitting down together. Or maybe it's even worse than that. Maybe it's not really strangers sitting together. Maybe you feel like there's actually some animosity around your Thanksgiving table or around your holiday gatherings. maybe you feel like it's not just strangers. Maybe you feel like there's some tension here. There's some real awkwardness. There's some real, there's just some things in our family or just some things in our get-togethers that just aren't right. You have to navigate that kind of tension and that kind of awkwardness. And sometimes you feel like, literally, this is not literally, but you feel like, you know, we really could be, you know, pilgrims and Indians, you know, like just totally different worlds, just completely should be at odds with each other in every natural thing. But here we are over a meal coming together just to share something together. And that's what I love. That's what I love about Thanksgiving. But the question I want to answer this morning is, how do we relate to others even when it feels unnatural? How do we relate to others even when it's a little bit awkward, even when it feels unnatural? Maybe you can look back at last Thursday and think, boy, yeah, it was a challenge relating to others, even as it feels a little bit unnatural. Maybe Christmas is coming up and you're thinking, you know, these people are going to be in town, and I don't know how this is going to go down. I don't know what's going to happen, but there's a situation. How do you relate to other people, even when it feels unnatural? Our text this morning is from 2 Samuel Chapter 9. So if you'll turn there with me. 2 Samuel chapter 9. We looked at this with the teenagers Wednesday, and I just thought, you know, I have to share this because I just love this story. When I think about, like, the original, if there's like a Bible version of Thanksgiving, you know, it's this American holiday. If there's like a Bible version of Thanksgiving, I think it's this story. If I'm ever going to point to, you know, there are Thanksgiving feasts, you know, maybe the Passover you could look at, maybe, well, it's like a big meal, maybe it's like a thing. I think this is like, this is up there in terms of, there's like a biblical Thanksgiving story. 2 Samuel chapter 9, I think is it. And through the lives of two very different people, this morning we're going to see two ways of relating to others, even when it feels unnatural. So there's two very different people we're going to look at, and they're going to teach us about how to relate to one another, even when it feels unnatural. So 2 Samuel chapter 9, we'll start with verse 1. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now, if you're not familiar with the story, if you're not familiar with the life of David, even if you are familiar with the life of David, this is a story that you tend to kind of skip over. It's not one of the great battles. It's not one of the great, you know, action type sequences. You're not going to make a movie about this, really. I guess you could. But it's not really that exciting. And David's life is all about excitement and adventure and action. This is not that. So if you're studying the life of David, you might have skipped over this chapter in your reading, but this is one of the great. This is just an amazing. I love this story. But when it comes to the life of David, there's two things you need to know in terms of like major characters in his life. You have one of the major characters in the life of David is Saul, right? And Saul is his arch nemesis, to put it kind of mildly, right? Saul, the first king of Israel, you know, kind of this whole inappropriate situation where they wanted a king, and Saul, he's better looking and stronger and taller than anyone, so let's make him king, and it's a horrible idea. But Saul, he's the king. And Saul is David's absolutely just arch nemesis, and that's the person he's gonna be at odds with for his early life, right? He's gonna be literally at war with Saul. Either hunting him or being hunted, right, by Saul, and escape, hiding in caves to get away from him, kind of a thing. And, you know, as, even after David has been anointed as the legitimate king of Israel, you still have Saul who's reigning in power, and there's that whole exchange that goes on between David. Fascinating stuff. The other person in David's life you need to be familiar with is a guy by the name of Jonathan. And this is David's absolute best friend. Imagine, if you want to look at like best friends in the Bible, David and Jonathan is the primary example of that. You have these two guys, and they're just like this the whole time. Now the catch is, Jonathan is Saul's son. Now just think about what kind of, this is soap opera craziness, right? His very best friend, the person he's closest to, the person he shares all the secrets with, the person who understands him more than anyone else, is the son of his arch rival, his arch nemesis, Saul. And even, can you imagine, even Jonathan, right, he has to like, you know, well, my friend, you know, I'm Saul's son, I should be king, but here my best friend has just been anointed king, and that whole, boy, you think about difficult family gatherings, that would be just, man, all these different relationships and all the tension that would have happened all just through that situation. So you have David, you have Saul, you have Jonathan. Now in 2 Samuel chapter 9 we pick up. This is David has just been crowned, or has just kind of for the first time in his life, really, he's now just realizing what it's like to be king of Israel. He's anointed a long time ago. He's been finally installed as king. Finally, the north and the south he's able to get under his control. He's the greatest king in Israel's history. He's the greatest king probably in this period of world history at the time. And he has more power and more just wealth and influence than anyone else living at his time. He is king of Israel, both north and south. This is absolutely incredible. And if you want to know how people act, if you want to know like people's like character and what they're really made of, just observe them when they suddenly acquire like power, or they suddenly acquire money, like more money than they've ever seen, or when they suddenly have some kind of new thing. You can kind of look and you can kind of see people. Okay, who are you really? What are you really made of? And we're gonna see kind of what David is really made of here. This is kind of his first the first deal as king. This is kind of who he is. This is what starts his administration. Every president kind of has their first thing that they do, you know, the first 100 days in office, kind of a thing they kind of watch. Okay, what policies are they going to, you know, get through, or what agenda are they going to try to accomplish? This is David's kind of first 100 days in office, if you will, as king. 2 Samuel chapter 9. He's looking to show kindness. He made an agreement with Jonathan that he would show his family kindness forever because of the relationship he had with Jonathan. And long story short, Saul's entire family, Jonathan, the rest of his kids, just to put it simply, they died in battle earlier on, and they're not living anymore. But David, he's looking to honor that agreement he made with Jonathan. So who can I show kindness to for Jonathan's sake? Now, verse 2. Now, there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." So Saul, as a great influential king, as his own kind of administration, he'd have his, well, entourage kind of with him. He'd have servants to do kind of whatever he would want to do and happen. So Ziba, even though Saul was, I guess, killed in battle, what Ziba, he's still around, he's still there. So David comes to him, sends a messenger to him probably, and says, you know, "Ziba, is there anyone still here?" This is the guy in charge. This is the, he kind of runs the palace for Saul, kind of a person. And so he said, "I am your servant." Verse 3, the king said, this is David, "Is there still not someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in his feet." This is how David starts his term. This is how David starts, not term, but his reign, administration, right? This is how he starts. Is there someone I can show kindness to? Not, you know, how can I advance my own agenda? Not how can I, what can I get done? Not how can I become more powerful? Not how can I acquire more wealth? Not how can I have more influence? Not how can the history books reflect better, you know, on me? Rather, he's saying, you know, is there just anyone I can show kindness to now that I've encountered this great power? Now that I've, you know, come across this great wealth? How can I use it to show kindness someone else? This is David's first 100 days. And this is what he wants to do. This is the kind of person he's made of. This is the kind of character he has. He's not looking to, you know, set out for himself. He wants to be generous toward someone else. And I think, you know, why would David do this? Like, why would David go through, you know, just suddenly be possessed to just, you know, "I think I'm just going to show kindness. I think I'm just going to, you know, I don't know, I have a bunch of money. I don't know what to do with it. I think I'll just give it to someone who has no clue what's going on. I think I'll just," why would he do that? Why do that? If I want you to turn over a couple pages, actually just one page, probably to your left, in 2 Samuel chapter 7. And what's going on here is David's having a conversation with the Lord about, you know, the temple that he wants to build, and the house he's going to build. And the Lord kind of corrects me. He's like, "Look, David, you don't build me a house. You know, everything I have, you know, everything in the world is ultimately mine anyway. You don't build a house for me. I will build a house for myself. But I will let you be part of that." And that's the deal. And in the midst of that great dialogue and that great conversation, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 8, this is what the Lord reminds David of. He's speaking to, I think, Nathan, and he's going to relay this message back. So 2 Samuel 7, verse 8. Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David. Nathan's going to tell David this from the Lord. "Thus said the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be prince over my people Israel. I just think about that. We're in our life groups, we're going through a series by Matt Chandler in the book of Philippians, and in one of the sessions we watched, I love how he tells this, where he's like, you know, you have this great story of Samuel the prophet, and he's looking, to be the next, for the next king of Israel. And he goes up to Jesse, and Jesse has all his sons there, and he's like, Jesse, I think one of your sons is gonna be king of Israel. And Jesse's like, that's great, let's find out which one it is. And right, Samuel, he goes through the line, and he's like, you sure you don't have any other sons here? And Jesse's like, well, no, they're all here. Of course they're all here. All my sons are here. Now, which one's going to be king? And Samuel's like, none of these guys are going to be king. You sure you don't have any other sons here? And Jesse, oh, that's right. There's this guy, David. Not David, where's he at? Oh, he's singing songs to sheep out in the field. I don't think he's who you want. No, I think it might be. No, I don't think it is. I think it's got to be someone else here. I don't think it's, the guy writing songs to sheep in the field. I don't think he's going to be king of Israel. I really don't. Well, let's get him here and find out. And sure enough, anoints him. King of Israel right there in front of all of his brothers. This weakling, son who's just singing songs to sheep out in the pasture. God says, I took you from that and I made you king. Verse 9, and I have been with you wherever you went, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make for you a great name, like the name of the great ones of the earth. And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly. From the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel, I will give you rest from all your enemies. He takes David from nothing. And he makes him king of, at the time, the greatest nation in the world. So I think about, why would David suddenly just do this for some random person he doesn't even know? It's because of what God has done for him. Because of the amazing kindness God has shown him, the amazing generosity God has shown him. Now David, in his own heart, wants to show kindness and wants to show generosity, even to the son of his arch rival, even to the grandson of his enemy, Saul. The first way we relate to others, even when it feels a little awkward, even when it feels a little unnatural, is we show them kindness. The way we relate to others, even when it feels unnatural, is to show them kindness or generosity. I think about it's holiday time and there's family gatherings. Every year I hear stories of people doing this. Whatever church I'm in, wherever I'm at, in college or in seminary or here or wherever, is every year I always hear about someone always just opening up their house to have people over who don't have somewhere to go during those significant times. I always hear stories about this, wherever I'm at. And I think, boy, that's an amazing thing, as a Christian, for people you don't even know, just to have an open invitation to what should be just a closed family gathering, right? I love, family gatherings, knowing who's going to be there and just having that closed, kind of thing where it's like, I feel safe. This is my family. This is the people I'm comfortable with. These are people I know. These are people I've grown up with. I like that security of just having family here at Thanksgiving. And I hear about people who say, I'm going to give up that security. I'm going to give up that safety. And I'm just going to show kindness and generosity just to whoever wants to come over and have a good. We show kindness and generosity even when it feels unnatural. Let's meet the second character in the story, the guy who's crippled in both of his feet. Verse 4 of 2 Samuel chapter 9. It's the son of Jonathan. So verse 4, the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba, this is the servant of Saul, he said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. Now I looked up this name, Lo Debar. And this is kind of in the middle of nowhere. This is kind of backwater Israel kind of place. And Lodabar, the name Lodabar, it means, it literally means no pasture is the name of the town. So whenever they named this town, there was like nothing there. There was no economy. There was no pasture. There's not even a place to feed your sheep. That's how out of the way and run down this place is. This is like the worst, you know, like where? I've never heard of that place. Oh yeah, it's this place. He's in a town called No Pasture. That's where this guy's living. Boy, this sounds like a real winner. This is going to be great. Verse 5. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at No Pasture, at Lodabar. At No, you know, I just can't get over that. Let's just name our town. Why would you name your town? Like, oh, no money here. Keep going. Anyway. Verse 6. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. Now, something you have to understand. When a new king comes to power, when there's a new administration, when there's a new thing, the first thing a king normally does is he kind of sits down with his advisors and he kind of has like a list of people. And he's like, okay, who are the rivals to my throne? Who if there's going to be like a rebellion, if there's going to be a coup d'etat, who's going to lead that? Okay, well, it's going to be, you know, probably this person, probably the family of the last king who was there. He was probably going to problem. You have these people. And the king says, okay, let's just kill all of them. That way I don't have to worry about this. And all their families, too. Let's just get rid of them. And then I won't have to worry about any rebellions in my empire. So here's what happens, right? The son of, you know, Saul, his arch nemesis, the person who's trying to kill him for pretty much, you know, his whole life, significant life recorded about him up to this point. Hey, let's get his grandson in here. Let's go get him from this town called No Economy, and let's go get him, and let's bring him to my throne, because you know what usually happens? Well, he's going to be gone. Because if anyone's going to take over my throne, it's going to be this guy. So go get him. Right? This is what Mephibosheth is thinking. Right? So the servant of David shows up. I thought you'd be here. I thought you'd want to see me. And, well, let's go, you know, to Jerusalem. Let's, you know, get on the, whatever, the camel, let's go. Okay. So this long walk to Jerusalem, right, from wherever this place is. And you can just imagine, he's sitting before David. David's like, are you Mephibosheth? And he's like, yeah. Now, what he could have done, right, he could have been kind of angry. He could have been kind of mad, because here's David, here's this guy, right? He's lived his life in poverty. He's crippled in both feet, so he can't really do anything himself. Anything he has in life is going to be provided for him by his family. And he's just not really doing well at all. Now, the tendency is, I think, he could have become very, very bitter, and he could have become very, very resentful at David and kind of the you know, as a person in power. It's very easy to become jealous, become envious, and then get kind of bitter and be kind of conceited toward people who have what we don't. And so he could have said, I could just imagine this, right? He's going to die anyway. Here he is before David at his throne. He could have just, like, you know, spit on him. He could have just, you know, had, you know, unkind words to say to him and say, you know, forget you. I don't like you anyway. You know, hate your family. You know, whatever. Whatever he could have said. But instead, he actually bows down to him. He actually gives him honor just by being there. This is an interesting person. It says, behold, I'm your servant, verse 7. David said to him, you're dead, right? This is what he's going to say. No, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always. When I think about Thanksgiving, when I think about two sides coming together, when I think about pilgrims just showing up and being like, hey, let's have a meal together, if that even happened or not, who knows, but it's that great story that we all celebrate, the values that we kind of, you know, bring to that. This is David, right? He's saying, no, eat at my table. Yeah, you have nothing. You're from the land called No Economy. Let's come and eat at my table forever, even though 5 minutes ago I didn't know you and you didn't. Verse 8, and he paid homage and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I. This is, rather than saying, well, you know, it's about time I got some recognition around here. It's about time that the chips started falling my way. It's about time, you know, finally the wealthy king does something for the people. No, he doesn't say that at all. He had, like, think of his attitude, right? Who am I that you should regard such a dead dog as me? This is not a term of endearment. You know, sometimes in, I don't know, American culture, we think of, you know, dogs as being this great thing, like puppy love, or, you know, puppy dog eyes or things. This is not that, right? This is a miserable creature in the Bible. So 1 Samuel 17:43, this is Goliath, right? And the Philistine says to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. I love this story, Mark 7. He said to her, this is Jesus. He's talking to a woman from, she's half Syrian, half Phoenician, and she has no status whatsoever in Israel. And he's somehow with her. And she wants to kind of be with him. And he said to her, let the children be fed first. For it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Right? This is Jesus talking to this woman of low status. Right? I love her reply. But she answered him, yes, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. What does Jesus tell her? You know, I haven't seen faith like this in all of Israel. Yeah, you know, yeah. Right, this is term of this incredible self-abasement here. Right, for Mephibosheth to say, you know, I'm just a dead dog. I have no use. I have no value in society. I have no... I'm such a burden to everyone. Who am I that you should regard me like this? The second way we relate to others, even when it feels unnatural, is to humbly enjoy their presence. The second way we relate to others, even when it feels unnatural, is to humbly enjoy their presence. And for Mephibosheth to not have an attitude, to not like talk back at David, to not be resentful or be somehow prideful against him, and to just say, I'm not even worthy to be here. I would love, David, to sit at your table and be with you for the rest of my days. This is a humble, humble person. This is a person who has not become bitter. This is a person who has not let his suffering cause him to be prideful. This is a person who just takes what David has to offer and can humbly enjoy his presence. And how hard is that? When it feels unnatural, when it feels awkward, just to humbly not have an opinion or status of ourselves and just to be around someone for the sake of being around them. I remember kind of observing this in my own life. I think it's as a young person, this goes back a few years, but as a young person, it's easy to, I think, write off or disregard the company of older people because we feel like their life circumstances are so much different than ours that we couldn't relate to them. And so the tendency is to say, you know, you don't understand what I'm going through. And it's not because I don't like you, but it's just because you don't really understand. To have a significant conversation with an older person is kind of difficult because it's not immediately useful. Like it's very, very difficult to relate to them, I think, in a significant way. So my grandparents growing up, I had this kind of standoffish kind of relationship where it was like, I don't really want to share and open up because your life is so much different than mine. We couldn't possibly have a conversation. I couldn't possibly enjoy just being around you because what experience, you know, do you have that I have? Which is totally untrue at all, but this is how we think. And I just remember, I think it was an illness that one of my grandparents had that made me just kind of, you know, they were in the hospital for a while, and I just remember thinking, you know, there may not be much time left with Grandpa. And every time we go over to his house, I think what I'm going to do, I think I'm just going to, like, make a point just to sit down and have some kind of conversation and just strike up some kind of thing, you know, just to at least try. And sometimes it went nowhere, but a lot of times it did. And I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to just humbly, as much as I can, humbly enjoy the presence of this person who I really have nothing in common with from my own point of view speaking. And I think, you know, it's a lot of times I think we think, you know, with people it's awkward or people, you know, it's unnatural to be around. I think we think, boy, they're so much different than we are, but and they're not. You know, David and Mephibosheth, how different are their worlds? How different are the realities that they're in? You know, what could Mephibosheth possibly have to relate to King David, the most powerful person in the world, him being like one of the weakest? Like nothing, right? But yeah, David's like, sit at my table. And Mephibosheth, you know, that's awkward. You know, you're going to be talking about kingly things, and here I am, you know, I can't even, you know, use my feet very well. And how am I going to even relate to what you do? But he accepts, right? He humbly enjoys the gift and the presence of David. Who do you need to be more intentional about enjoying the presence of someone else? Maybe it's your grandkids. Maybe they just really annoy you with their fancy, you know, gadget stuff. And it's like, you know what? Maybe it's someone else. Maybe it's your parents. Maybe it's the weird relative that you don't really see that much, and they have their own inside jokes that you don't understand, and you just think, well, they're in the kitchen. I think I'll go, you know, in the living room. Who is that person in your life that you need to be more intentional about humbly enjoying their presence? How do you accept gifts from others? When someone gives you a gift, what is your response? It's so hard, right, to accept a gift from another person, because you're saying, I need this, or I am going to, you know, accept this generosity, or, you know, because we want to say, no, I don't need that. Please don't give me that gift. I'm not dependent upon you. You know, I don't need this. So hard, right, to accept a gift from another person, unless you're humble, unless you can humble yourself and say, thank you. The story, it's a good story. I think it's this first kind of Thanksgiving kind of moment here in the Bible. And it's a great story about David. But the reason I really love this story is it's not just about David. Right? This is an amazing illustration of the love Christ has for us. Right? People, we should not sit at the table with Christ, right? Like we're in the town of no economy. We're disabled, whatever. We have no reason to think that God would think anything of us at all. But because of the relationship he has with his son, the Father looks upon us and says, eat at my table. Be with me. Enjoy all my servants, all the blessings of my house. They can be not because of anything we've done, right? What did Mephibosheth do? What merit does he have? There's nothing he can do. There's nothing he can do to earn the favor of David at all. Wait, how is he going to contribute to the economy of Jerusalem or the economy of Israel? Nothing. He can't. If he could somehow manage to, like, plant crops or something, what, that'd be like three stalks of corn, you know, the entire city. This would not be a significant contribution at all. There is no value to David to showing him kindness at all. And there is no value for God to show us. Because there's nothing we have to give him. There's nothing we have that he's going to be like, you know, I really need him in my kingdom. I could really use that person. That's an up-and-coming, you know, boy. Yeah, I should get that person saved so we can have this great, you know, I have a lot of things that we can. No, there's nothing. There's nothing at all. He looks upon us. We are just miserable dead dogs. And he says, eat at my table. Enjoy the blessings of my house forever. I just can't get my mind around that. And that's exactly what David does. What Christ does for us is so amazing. I heard a story about a little girl named Susie. And Susie's dad, she traveled all over the world. Every time he came back from his travels, he brought Susie a doll. And Susie was only about 8 or 9 at the time, and she had one of the most incredible doll collections anyone had ever seen. She had dolls from China and Africa and Mexico and Japan and France and Egypt. And one night, a business associate came over to the house and had dinner, and afterwards the father proudly walked him upstairs with Susie to show off the doll collection. As you can imagine, dolls from all over the world. The visitor stood in awe of all the glass cases filled with hundreds and hundreds of dolls. And he said, "Susie, this is incredible. I have never seen anything like this. What is your very favorite doll?" Susie didn't hesitate. She went into her closet and reached down into a bucket and pulled out a doll. The doll was messy to the point of being broken. It was missing an eye. The arm was chewed off. The hair was ratty. Some clothes were missing. It was stained. Susie said, "This is my very favorite doll." The visitor was a little stunned and asked, Why is that your very favorite doll?" She paused and looked intently at the doll and then back up at the visitor and said, "If I didn't love this doll, no one else would. If David didn't love Mephibosheth, no one else would. And if Christ didn't love us, no one else would." And I love Christmas because we get to reflect upon that. We get to take a time aside and say, why did the King of the universe stoop so low to become human, to be born in a manger in the most humiliating way? Because he loved us when no one else would. Let's pray. Father, you are the King of Kings. Your Son is the Lord of Lords. And you have sent him to be a sacrifice, to be with us, so that we can be with you forever. Father, thank you for loving us enough to give us your Son. When we were dead in our trespasses and sins, you, in your grace and mercy, have made us alive with Christ and have given us every spiritual blessing that we have. Father, thank you for the gift of your Son. And it's in his name that we pray.